What happened today, Alan?
Absolute thunderbolt.
This is the Rich Eisen Show.
The LIV Tour just merged with the PGA Tour. It stinks.
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
Are we serious? The LIV Tour and the PGA Tour are merging. How in the hell does that work?
Earlier on the show, CNBC journalist David Farber. Coming up, Pro Football Hall of Famer Terrell Davis. Actor Patty Considine. Host of NBC's America's Got Talent, Terry Crews. And now, it's Rich Eisen.
Hour number two of the Rich Eisen Show is on the air. We just had a wild first hour talking about the day after the LIV Tour and the PGA Tour combining forces in a way that we never thought would be possible. The reporter from CNBC, David Farber, who broke that story, joined us in hour number one, and we had quite the chat. The king of House of the Dragon, King Viserys himself, Patty Considine, the actor, is in studio, and we'll be chatting with him coming up. Terry Crews is in studio in hour number three. But let's kick off hour number two in style, okay? Let's just say you're a Pro Football Hall of Famer, okay?
Oh, thank you.
And you represent a town because you are not only a Pro Football Hall of Famer, but the way you played for this town not only elevated you to Pro Football Hall of Fame status, but you're also a terrific member of the community. So you're out and about, and you're face of the city that's now on full display for the whole world to see if you're in the stands of, say, an NBA Finals game. Let me just choose one, two. Mm. Okay. And your team is not performing well. You have to maintain some sort of poise because you might be on camera. You're a public figure. You're a Pro Football Hall of Famer, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just say you're that individual. And two people from the visiting team that is, what's the word for it, curb stomping your team out of the blue starts chirping, from what it appears, in your ear. How do you handle it? Chris, how would you handle it? Let me answer it for you. Not as well as Terrell Davis, who joins us here on the Rich Eisen Show. How are you doing, TD? How are you?
Hey, you set that up well, Rich.
Thank you,
that
sir.
Was nice. That was set up well. But what you didn't see,
okay?
You saw the two, ladies on the left of me.
Yes.
Screen right.
Yes.
There was a gentleman on the opposite side. I was next to my wife, and then next to my wife was another Heat fan, and his wife.
What's going on?
And so every time that the Heat would make, a simple basket, they would high five across my face, my wife's face. And this went on from the first quarter all the way till, obviously when the Heat started to pull away. And so that look on my face, I didn't even know it. I was just asking myself, like, how did I end up at a Nuggets game, sitting behind the Heat's bench, sandwiched between Heat fans.
Mm.
And, being in the middle of the celebration. And so when you look at me, you see that kind of like, I'm kind of puzzled look. Some people think I was sleeping, but I had had enough of the celebration across my
time. So who, do we know who these people were? Did you get to meet them? Did you at least say at some point, I'm fine with Reggie White invading my personal space, but not you folks. Like, is that fine? What do you got?
No. Well, I met them when I first sat down.
Oh, okay.
So I took pictures with them and stuff like that. But they were cool. They were cool people, But the guy to the right of us was consuming quite a bit of alcohol pretty early in the game. So I don't know if he was going to do anything differently than what he did. But it wasn't mean. They weren't being mean. They were just celebrating and having a good time. And we just happen to be caught right in the middle of it.
Okay, game five. Are we going to have better seats for game five that is currently necessary?
I hope, man. That's the plan.
You're right behind. But by the way, Kevin Love is right in front of you. I mean, that is was your view obstructed, not just by the high fivers across your personal space?
Yeah,
Terrell Davis.
It was. I didn't even look at the seats. My wife got we got the tickets, and so we went to the game. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't realize until we got to our seats and sat down. We were literally right behind the Heat's bench, and so close you can hear Eric Spoelstra talking, and I can hear the game plan and all the players coming off the court. And what they were saying and the things they were talking about. But, we realized pretty early that these seats were not the greatest seats in the world. And so the second quarter, I had went back into the line, they have a club there. So we had went back into the club and just started, having a few drinks and ate back there for the most part. And then we came out, like, listen, if we're going to come to the game, we might as well go, experience the environment, not just sitting back in the club seat. So.
Okay. Good for you. Terrell Davis here on the Rich Eisen Show. So you're so close, I'm mandated to ask, is there any similarity between an NBA huddle and an NFL huddle? Anything that you noticed?
You know what it is? It's just recognizing before that game, I remember looking at some of the players, and you're always trying to read your team and how, especially before a big game. And I do remember sitting there looking at the Heat players and thinking, these guys look ready to play just by, just the nonverbals we say, just the way they look, the intensity in their eyes. They kind of have this collective, we're going to show the world look, and they came out and played like it. So, as a player, you're always trying to look at teammates. And even before a big game, is everybody ready to play? And, I used to do that when I played with the Broncos, like looking around. And then you feel either good about it or you don't. And I thought that the Heat were ready to play before that game.
So what, did you pick anything up on Spoelstra, like his style, or Butler talking to him, or his style? I mean, did you pick anything up being that close? I'm serious. This is fun.
Just serious. What I noticed is that he has a pretty even keel about him. He's not up and down. Okay. I love coaches like that, who it's not screaming and shouting when things go wrong and then celebrating when things go good. It's like, it reminds me a little bit of Mike Shanahan, where he just, even though Mike has a little bit more intense look on his face and people think that Mike is always screaming, he's not. And that's what, Coach Spoelstra was just really, really just calm. And everything he talked about was just, you could tell that he's got a really good handle on that team and a good pulse for the players and how they're coming in, making different moves. I think Kevin Love started that game, which was kind of a surprise to a lot of people. But, no, man, it was good. I wasn't sitting there taking notes. But
no, I love it.
I'm just telling you just kind of from what my initial reaction was from that moment. It was like, man, this is interesting. I see why people kind of stick close to the bench.
I would think Spoelstra reminds you of Shanahan because that raging tan. Maybe that's what it is, too.
That, too. It is quite nice. That's South Beach.
But, well, I mean, it's South Beach, right? Shanahan, I don't know what that is. Mike doesn't fake bake, right? I mean, he doesn't do that, right?
No, of course not.
Okay.
Of course not.
Could be the Rocky Mountain sun. What's your take on the Broncos? I have no idea what the hell they're going to look like. What are they going to look like, TD, this year? What do you got?
I feel really good. I had spent some time with Sean Payton about 3 weeks ago at the facility.
Yep.
And you can already see it, man. He's already put his fingerprint on the franchise. Like, you can feel there's a different vibe. Again, I go back to Mike because Mike was the greatest coach I had ever played for. And anytime I see anybody who is taking pieces that resembles what Mike Shanahan has done, it speaks to me. And so Sean Payton has come in there. He's already sort of changed the culture. You don't hear anything come out of Broncos camp, right? You don't hear anything. Like, he's locked it down. And his first message when he first got here was, hey, guys, we want a bunch of anonymous donors. And that made sense. Like, you don't need to show the world what you're doing. You don't need to post everything. You don't need to, brag about lifting weights or training, anything like that. Just do it behind closed doors where no one's watching you. And then we'll show the world what you've been doing. And I love that. I love that message that he sent to the team, and they're doing that. He's not coming in trying to win the press conferences. He's not trying to win the fans over with a lot of talk. It is just going to work, and I feel like this is the reset is awesome, and we'll see in the fall what that looks like. But I think it's going to turn not only this team into a team that's stabilized, but am I saying Super Bowl? No, I'm not saying that. But I think they'll be a contender and a good challenger in year one.
Well, I mean, look, and this is not a slight on Nathaniel Hackett, TD, but last year the whole conversation coming in and throughout is the question is Hackett cut out for this, right? Can he hack it, right? And
right.
and having Sean Payton there removes that 1,000%. It's not even a thought of even twitching in that direction of having a thought, right? The question is, go ahead.
Because what you said is of course we were excited last year with Nathaniel Hackett. And I think every year you try to say, what coach is right for this situation? Last year, I think the exciting coach was appropriate. You know, the franchise had been struggling the previous year.
Yeah.
With Fangio, Vance Joseph. And so to bring an exciting coach in, I think that was appropriate for that time because everybody was kind of down on the Broncos. And so I'm not knocking that move, but I think now that you've been through three first-time head coaches, the right move is an experienced coach who knows what it looks like. Not a coach who thinks he knows what it looks like, but a coach who knows what it feels like, who understands the nuances of the difference between – you know, things that you think and things you know. And Sean, even all the years he spent in New Orleans, he had a laundry list of things that he would do differently. And so that's coming off experience. And that's what the Broncos needed, was somebody who can reset the team to just an experienced coach. By the way, he was really good with quarterbacks. We seen what they did with Teddy Bridgewater, obviously Drew Brees, Taysom Hill. And so I think all of that is starting to materialize, and we'll see the product in the fall. But man, I'm excited about it because it's not a lot of just talk; it's a lot of substance, and that's what gets me pretty excited about this season.
Well, and the reason why I brought up the fact that Peyton's got a sterling reputation coming in as a Super Bowl winning head coach, right? And he's coming in knowing what he knows, and that was a huge question last year. The coach, reason why I bring that up is the Russell Wilson part of it. And, you know, and I'm not asking this question facetiously, but I'll ask you, when you were walking around the facility, does Russ still have that second floor office or is that gone? Best you can tell.
Yeah, best I can tell. I don't know if it's there. I think it's gone.
Okay.
I can't confirm that.
No, I hear you. But the reason why I ask that is just, again, like things are maybe going to be different this year, just from that point, that aspect of the locker room, and Russ having an opportunity to have a guy with a ring, you know, and a sterling, as I mentioned, reputation as a quarterback guy, how is that going to work in your estimation?
Yeah,
TD.
You know, it's. I think it's interesting that all of those things were happening. You know, where Russ had his own office, you know, he had his own kind of quarterback coach mm-hmm. at practice, and no one really said anything until things got bad, and then it became, oh, you know, all of these things became a problem.
Yep.
With Russ, and it's like, well, that's, we all were going to try to point fingers to all that, you know, being the problem. I don't believe that was like the single reason things didn't go well. But it's easy to point to that when things don't go well. And we always say that, like, hey, you can have privileges. But if you're not winning, then those privileges, they get taken away. And so I just think the other thing that it could have done, and I don't know this, and I'm just speculating, as a player, you like to see all players be treated, and there's never going to be an even, you know, treatment of players. You know, the best players get treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
But it is striking when if you're up in the locker, and let's say John Elway comes in and John has an office upstairs, and you know it kind of sets that, hey, listen, there's a tier here, and I'm sort of above the team, you know, and I've always told in sports that we're all the same, right? We're all, even though we have different roles, we all have important roles that are important for the success of the team. And I know, you know, playing with John and Shannon and Steve Atwater, I saw these guys and I watched them, and they were just team guys, and they didn't want anything different. The treatment was all the same. John didn't wear a red jersey at practice. You know, John wasn't taking different transportation to a game. He wasn't doing anything different. He was one of the team, one of the guys on the team. I think that that was part of what endeared a lot of players to John Elway. And so when I saw that, then, of course, I tried to model that. So when anybody came in and saw TD, they didn't feel like, oh, well, TD thinks he's better. So it's just things like that where you can keep everybody feeling like they're all kind of the same level, even though we know the, you have your superstar players. I think that's the important part of having a real good team.
I appreciate it. Absolutely. Especially when they had an actual spatial arrangement where that he was literally above the team on the second floor. Like, you know what I mean? It does. So tell me quickly about Defy. You won your Defy, the official CBD beverage of Spartan US. You won awards, huh? You got some awards
here?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
You?
Like you, Rick, you over there winning all those awards.
No, I get nominated for them. You actually win them, so good for you.
Well, yeah, we won a couple of awards. We won Best CBD Drink. Then we won Best Low to No Sugar Drink out of about a 15-category contest. And it was pretty impressive because we only entered into three of those categories, and we won two of those. So it was pretty good. Pretty good for a small company.
All right. Well, TD, congratulations on that. Everybody check out Defy, which is Terrell Davis's award-winning drink, the official CBD beverage of Spartan US. Call Marshall to call Stan Kroenke and get you tickets behind the Nuggets bench, please. Come on now.
I'm on it, man. I'm on it.
Get on it. Get on it. Love you, TD. Take care. You be well.
Likewise, brother. Nice to hear from you.
Terrell Davis, same here. At Terrell _ Davis right here on the Rich Eisen Show. Let's take a break and bring in the king. All hail. All rise. The king himself is here on the Rich Eisen Show. King Viserys Targaryen of House of the Dragon, Patty Considine, coming up. Men, do you get distracted during the day thinking about your underarms sweating, itching, or emitting an odor? Do those thoughts keep you from showing care when it counts? New and improved Dove Men Plus Care Antiperspirant with 72-hour sweat and odor protection and 1/4 moisturizing cream helps you forget about your underarms so you can be present for the moments that matter. Don't let underarm insecurities keep you at arm's distance from the ones you care about. Buy new and improved Dove Men Plus Care Antiperspirant wherever personal care products are sold.
Get an inside look at Hollywood with Michael Rosenbaum. Actress Kristen Ritter.
Your parents let you travel by yourself.
It was a different time.
They just put you on a train. As a 15-year-old girl, you went to New York.
I went on a bus, and I did get picked up at Port Authority. They thought I was a runaway.
What would they do?
They'd detain you and like get people on the phone, and then they finally let you go to your modeling job.
But how many times did it happen?
Once or twice.
It just seems like it wouldn't happen.
It happens, yeah.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum, wherever you listen.
Patty Considine here on the Rich Eisen Show. House of the Dragon is available on Max, which is available on Roku. And the man who plays King Viserys is here. I mean, what do you think of when you watch yourself back as the king?
Oh, Patty? God. I mean, I don't really like to watch myself acting. So I look at that particular clip then and go, why are you doing all that whispery acting stuff? Well, it seemed like a good choice at the time.
Right.
But no, it's I can't help but be critical of it, so it's quite awkward. But
well, I mean, meeting you in person, I was keen to know what you would look like in person because, you know, yeah. I've known your work, but the most recent work, I've watched this show like, you know, the rest of the world, and just to see you here as a human being, it's a little jarring. I'm not going to lie. You know, I'm not
looking
gonna lie.
Young and without the sort of David Lee Roth hairdo and the leather. And
exactly. How long were you? Would you sit for this role before you had to even get on set?
Well, the kind of main look, the sort of earlier look for me, that that wasn't too bad. I think we got that down to about an hour and a half or something. You know, it was just mainly getting that wig on,
right?
Which is the actual selection of the wig is more complicated than it seems, you know, because they have to match the wig to your skin tone. Mm-hmm. I thought they'd just nip to Party City and buy a wig and plonk it on your head, you know, but it's very intricate, this,
right?
And but further on through the show, as he gets sort of sicker, those makeups were around the 4-hour mark. I thought it was longer, but I spoke to makeup the other day, and I think we got it down to about 3.5-4 hours in the end.
Well, that's what leprosy will do, I guess, you know, and we're looking at a shot on the screen right here.
There you go.
My goodness gracious. And then, of course, just I would imagine just hearing about the role and being able to do it, knowing what Game of Thrones was.
Yeah.
Were you a little concerned about being part of the next iteration, or were you all over this thing,
Pat? I was kind of all over it. It was weird how it happened, because we'd been in the lockdowns and we were all watching a lot of television during that time.
Yes.
And I'd put off watching Game of Thrones, and we'd started watching it in the lockdowns, and about three seasons in, and I got the call because things were opening up and moving on again. And my agent called and said, you know, are you a fan of Game of Thrones? And I was like, well, that's, you know, kind of weird coincidence, because we've been watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, they're making a prequel to it set so many years before it, and they want you to play the king. And I was like, right, okay. And so my first real reaction was elation, because
yes.
I thought this would be, I'd be honored to do it. And then I just went, oh, I hope it's not one of them where I get the script and he's in about three scenes and, you know, he's stood in the background. You know, I've been offered stuff in the past with some really great directors, but I'm literally an extra with a spear in my hand. And I went, I hope it's not one of those. And when I started reading it and read the first three episodes, I saw in the episode one alone, he goes through an awful lot.
Yes.
I saw that there was this great arc. And so then my next question was, well, who's turned it down? You know, who said no to this?
Come on. Right. Uh-huh.
And they were like, no, they've just come straight to you. You know, you they want you to play it. So I was like, right. And I was a fan of the show. I thought it was a brilliant show with so many fantastic performances in it. And honestly, I can say hand on heart that when I read it, I thought that it was going to be good. And I remember having conversations on set with Matt Smith even and saying, you know, I think this is going to be good.
Yeah.
I think we're making a good show. So.
All in.
Yeah, it was all in. Yeah.
So you first got to Game of Thrones only in the pandemic.
Only in the pandemic.
You're not part of the week in, week out, waiting then a year and a half for the
next. No.
So you got to binge watch this.
Yeah,
thing.
It completely passed me by. Completely. I mean, I do that with a lot of things. I brought the first series on a box set and it stayed in the cellophane for years.
A box set. I haven't heard that phrase in a while.
Remember those?
Of course, yes. In cellophane, I remember that too. Sure,
yeah.
Of course.
And it's just one of those things, you know, struggling for things to watch.
Right.
And, you know, I'm like that with everything, even with Breaking Bad. There was, I think, three seasons of that had gone by. And, you know, people saying, watch it, you'll love it. And I'm going, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll get around to it. And then I just couldn't stop watching it.
I watched Breaking Bad both ways. I watched it originally by myself, week to week as it was coming out.
Yeah.
My wife watched the pilot of it, was completely turned off by Walter White and who he was maybe becoming, and just she wasn't sold on it. And then about a year and a half in, I told her, I'm like, that's it. You have to catch up.
Yeah.
And so then I started binge watching it again. And then Game of Thrones was just that same way for her and I too. Because she's not into Dungeons and Dragons and things like that.
Yeah.
And so then I then watched it from you know, week to week. And then I told her, I'm like, that's it. You've got to get in on this. And the reason why I bring this up is binge watching Game of Thrones can warp your head, man. I mean, like,
yeah, it can.
Like, you just go one after another, and like suddenly you're walking out and about in society, and you think somebody's going to swing an axe at you.
What's going?
Put your head on a pike.
Nobody's safe. Nothing's safe. I say binge watch it. We'd watch two episodes a night. Because I remember, like, in the days of, do you remember 24, those days, the good old days?
Of course, yeah. Yeah. Where Jack Bauer had cell reception no matter where he went.
Absolutely. The right. best service provider that there is
exactly
going.
Right.
But I remember, like, we'd watch that and we'd sometimes watch four. And on the fourth one, you were literally, you know, nodding off to sleep and you're going, this ain't fair. This is nothing to do with Jack Bauer. We're just really tired and we shouldn't have put that fourth episode
exactly on. Right. Yeah, no, same way. We would binge watch a couple of seasons of 24 also, and then all of a sudden when we turn it off, we would be screaming at each other, we're running out of time. We have no idea why. It's exactly right. I've got Patty Considine here, who plays King Viserys here on the Rich Eisen show from House of the Dragon. And then just what was your reaction to the reaction of this show?
Yeah, it was quite interesting, because at first, you know, I don't think people could fully frame my character
Yes.
Properly, you know.
Because you're the great-great-grandfather of the Mother of Dragons, or you're the...
There might be a few more greats in front of that.
There might be a few more of that, okay.
Few more. I've been told that, you know. I was told once the amount of greats, but I've forgotten it. But there's a few.
Right. But you're the direct descendant.
She's a descendant, okay, yeah. Right. I loved all that. I loved it. Even my hair, which was really expensive, you know, had tones of Daenerys's palette in it, in my hair. And even little details like that for me. I know it's geeky, but I really like that.
Right.
You know, that there were those little links into the original show.
Absolutely. And Matt Smith does resemble, in a way, you know, her brother from the original Game of Thrones, who, spoiler alert, although I guess we're years removed, he doesn't last very long. He gets crowned in that as well.
Yeah.
So, but he looks just like him. Like, obviously.
He does. I mean, I was quite worried about the look, and I was trying to get out. It's a very distinct thing, the Targaryen look.
Yes.
And I was trying to get out of it a little bit. And I was saying, well, what if this guy's got short hair and, you know, we can probably dye my... And I look more like Lee Marvin and you can... They just weren't going for it at all. And I thought, my fear was that I looked utterly ridiculous in the wig. You know, I looked like some terrible sort of 80s... You know, LA rock.
You're a white snake.
And I'm not saying I didn't look ridiculous in the wig.
No,
but
you did. You look great.
When you've got everything on, it all fits.
Hey, man, like, again, for me, you know, when you're in a show like this, coming off of a show that's as iconic as Game of Thrones, there's going to be a whole bunch of people out there and go, that's not the real thing. That's not the real thing. That doesn't feel like the real thing. There's a lot of particular people out there. And, you know, House of the Dragon ticked every box.
Yeah, it did.
Every box. It certainly did. When the dragons are all over the place, too.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I never got to ride a dragon, unfortunately.
I know.
Which was, I was a bit disappointed about.
You wanted to hop on it.
I did, really, yeah. And then I realized, you know, when I saw that they were just days sitting up on this saddle, you know.
Is that how it's done?
Yeah. And they couldn't get down for toilet breaks and things like that.
What?
I was like, oh, actually, I dodged a bullet there, I think.
So they have to sit up there and just stay up there.
Yeah, and do all that sort of, you know, flying business.
I love that. Yeah. Fantastic. Patty Considine here on the Rich Eisen Show. All right, let's get into your career. You're a boxing enthusiast, correct?
I love boxing. Yeah, I've been a fan since I was a little kid, really.
Right.
Yeah.
So who's your favorite boxer? Who is it?
There's been a loads through history. In recent years, I absolutely love Manny Pacquiao. I was a big Manny Pacquiao fan.
Yeah, why is that?
I suppose with Manny, it was the whole story of his like humble beginnings and how he came off the streets and fought, made his way to America, and you know, walked into the wild card, and you know, was managed to create history.
Right.
I also love his style of fighting. You know, that sort of southpaw style of fighting and how he used to throw his left hands and stuff. It was very destructive, brilliant, phenomenal fight.
Right? I mean, obviously he's a great guy to look up to or root for. I mean, in heavyweight division, that's where, you know, some real I guess heavyweights come from. Your neck of the woods as well. I mean, are you a Lennox Lewis fan? Or
Lennox was one of the brilliant fighters of the you know, the modern age, modern age. You know, I think Lennox was one as well that when people look back on him, they hold him in very sort of high esteem.
Right. And we were talking before you sat down, we've had Tyson Fury here sitting in that chair.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it didn't used to be as wide as the chair that you are
until Tyson sat in it.
Well, he sat in it and his...
The Gypsy King.
Well, I got to be honest with you. He came here and we recorded it before we were on the air, right? He came here really early on a morning, Chris.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and so I went in the back and he had an entourage of about a dozen people. And I couldn't understand a word they were saying. I mean, seriously, it was like I needed subtitles like a Guy Ritchie movie, man.
It's not just an English accent or region, it's the traveler accent as well, isn't it? You know?
Oh, my gosh. And then he sat in the chair in like some pink short, like hot pink short shorts.
Very short shorts.
Right. They were, and his legs came all the way out to the middle of my desk. There it is. There he is right there.
Oh, yeah. He's looking very tan there. After the first Wilder fight?
It was. It was the one after one here in Los Angeles where a lot of folks thought he got counted out.
Oh, yeah.
That if, you know, that the 10 count was really kind of 11 and a half seconds.
Well, that happens a lot in boxing. That's common. You know, it is actually common for counts to go to 14 by the time people are up on, fighters are up on their feet.
Well, I dared to actually bring that up to him. And he wasn't terribly happy with the question, Patty. You know, that maybe he got a couple of seconds. But he also spoke eloquently, moving, about his battle with mental health.
Yeah.
I mean, a significant amount that he just put out there for everyone to see. And I think that's part of his popularity is how.
Yeah, he's been an inspiration. I mean, I've followed him since his first ever fight. Mm-hmm. And I've never missed a fight. I've actually been on set before and had his fight on a television next to where I'm filming.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to miss him fighting. And he's been on quite a journey, Tyson. There was a time where the British public weren't really, you know, favorable towards him. And I think when he went over and beat Klitschko, that was a phenomenal feat at the time to go into Europe and win on points. Because even if he won the fight, you know, a lot of fighters were coming back at that time and not getting the decisions, even though they kind of, sometimes they clearly won it, won the fight. So I thought it was a fantastic victory. He never quite came home to the hero's welcome that I think he deserved for that. And then he had a massive episode. It's well documented with his, you know, mental illness and putting on the weight. And I think the whole comeback story is such an incredible story. And it was just cemented by that 12th round against Deontay Wilder, who I think only wanted to fight Tyson because Tyson didn't look particularly great when he'd fought in Belfast previously. And that 12 rounds and that moment where he got up on the canvas is such a historic moment, an inspirational moment. And I think that was a springboard for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it made both fighters' names in America because Deontay wasn't even a massive name here.
If I'm not mistaken, that happened just down the road, right?
TJ and I were in the 12th row. Yeah, we were there.
Yeah, that happened right here in LA. Yeah.
I mean, it can be frustrating being a boxing fan at times because you want the big fights, you want them to be made.
Yeah.
And we've just seen the Fury-Usyk fight fall through back home. But apparently there's some big tournament happening in the winter that we're hearing whispers of that are involving like the top four heavyweights in the world. So it might happen in the Middle East. So hopefully.
Have you hopped into the UFC world or not? Not really. You're just more of a traditional boxing.
Yeah,
traditional
I've never. This sounds really weird, but I don't like fighting. I don't. If someone's fighting in the street, I don't take great pleasure in watching anything. I don't. This seems like a contradiction, but I don't love violence. Well, in that way, and boxing to me is just a little bit different. You know, it goes back in history. It's at its best, it's a great fighting art form, as is a lot of the jiu-jitsu things. But it's just never caught on for me. But I love watching documentaries about the UFC fighters, like the Gracies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can watch that stuff all day long because I find the artistic side of it fascinating.
And the stories and things like that. Sure.
Amazing, but I just don't really follow UFC.
So it's amazing, again, a testament to your wonderful acting, that King Viserys doesn't like violence. That's really strange since so much has happened in front of you.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't unsee some of the scenes that's happened in front of you. Do you have a favorite House of the Dragon scene that you were in?
I think, you know, because I don't really like to watch my acting at all. But when the eighth episode was on, my wife and daughter were watching it in the next room, and they got through the episode, and my wife came in to me, and she said, "You need to watch this." And I was sort of like, I can't because, you know, in my head, I'm okay with it. I made it. I'm at peace with it. It's fine. But if I see something I don't like, it's going to flip me out. And she goes, "No, you really need to watch it."
So which scene did she pull you into?
Well, she kind of showed me pretty much all of the stuff in episode 8, the walk to the throne.
Mm-hmm. When you could barely make it.
When I could barely make it. And there was a scene afterwards where I do a speech to my family.
At dinner,
yeah.
Oh, what a scene that is.
And then
man.
The final scene where I passed, you know, and which was quite shocking because unintentionally, but it just seemed to happen. You know, I don't want to bring the tone down, but my father died of cancer and we watched him die, you know, at home over a period of weeks. And I looked like the image of him. It was frightening.
No kidding.
It was just, and that was a bit too overwhelming to see, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's a funny one with me acting. There's so many times I've wanted to quit because I never thought I was particularly good at it. And but there was something about this. The timing felt right with House of the Dragon. I never had an education in acting ever. And somehow I've got this sort of career. But I did theatre a few years before. We did a show on Broadway called The Ferryman. And I feel like that was my acting school. Like something changed during that period of time. And I feel like when I watched that episode in particular, I felt like everything came together. And I could just, I felt for the first time in my life just a little bit of satisfaction where I went, no, you did a good job, man.
You did. I can tell you that. I can tell you that to your face. 1,000,000%. I mean, that dinner scene, the speech, and again, I don't want to give too much away because people should be able to catch up to this and binge watch it or what have you.
Yeah.
On Max, available right here on Roku, I should say. And so that was a remarkable scene where it looked like everyone was going to get along, then not so much.
Yeah.
And then you said everything came together. But then everything falls apart, and then the whole show starts twisting in a whole different direction.
Yeah.
And you were awesome in it. You should not think another second about it.
No. Well, thank you very much.
You're very
welcome. I appreciate it. But, like, yeah, I just felt like another – I just felt like I'd gone up a little level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Of course. And so your wife and your daughter are watching in another room. They're like, come on in here. Come on. You got to see this scene.
Yeah, yeah. They forced me.
How old's your daughter?
Frano's 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's age appropriate for House of the Dragon. Yeah. My 9-year-old, I'm not calling her in for
that. Watch your cards.
That ain't happening. Before I let you go, speaking of tremendous scenes, the scene in the Bourne Ultimatum in the Waterloo
train station. Yeah.
Where you are trying, well, Jason Bourne is talking you through trying to get you out of the Waterloo station. The CIA is trying to capture you. He's trying to get you through and out. Unbelievable scene. How long did that take you to shoot that, Patty?
Well, that scene was shot in about, I don't know, I want to say just a few days, but we went back. I think I was shot in about 5 different locations around that station.
Yes.
But the interesting story about it was that, you know, Matt's one of those guys who really is a really very down-to-earth guy. Matt, you probably had him on here.
Yes,
you know,
we have.
Great. He's a great guy.
He's good people, yes.
And we used to walk to set every day up to Waterloo, and we shot that amongst real commuters. So people were getting off trains, and literally we were in that station, and Jason Bourne was walking around, you know, the earpiece, the jacket, everything. Yeah. And it was such a joy. We had a window of like 10 minutes before the public started to realize that was Matt Damon. And the real joy was like, because I could see it all happening, was watching people's faces getting off the train, going to work. And then the odd person would look up and go, like, they'd flip out and go, did I just see right? So it wasn't just Matt Damon. It was Jason Bourne in the station.
I know, right?
So we'd have this little 10-minute window, and then we'd have to get out of there because, you know, it's Matt and everybody would start to recognize him.
So there was a 10-minute window in which people were still stuck in their commuting tunnel vision.
Yeah.
Thinking of their day or what a bad day they just had or a good day.
That's it. And then they'd spot Matt and see the cameras, and then that was it. A little circus would you know, start to form, and then it would get out of the way. Well, that's how we had to go about it. But I was being shot and collapsing in front of real commuters. So I'd literally be walking through people, and then they go, now, and I'd go, you know, and fall down on the floor.
Yeah.
So commuters would start looking around, go, what's happened to this guy?
Yeah.
And one woman walked past on one of the takes, screamed, got down on the floor, turned me over, and started performing like CPR on me.
Oh my God.
And tried to revive me because she was taking my pulse and doing all these checks. And I was just like, I don't tell her. And I just lay there and pretended and went along with it until one of the ADs came along and went, excuse me, madam, we're actually shooting a film. And I just couldn't do it. So I just lay there until she'd gone away.
That gives you faith in humanity, though. A little
that's
bit, huh?
What we all felt. Right. Everyone was really quite touched by it. One person.
That's the ultimatum, I guess, right there. Wow, that's so cool. Yeah, Matt is good people. So you would just like walk with him to set.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess you already asked my follow-up question. It looked like those weren't extras. Those were like genuine.
Yeah, we dressed them. Well, I didn't, but they dressed some in Paul Greengrass. They dressed some people in who were with us, and then the rest were just all commuters. Oh, yeah.
That scene, you were literally on the edge of your seat. And then, of course, he starts kicking ass and...
That was the thing with that. I'm watching him kick ass, and you just stood there lying, going, I'm going to kick some ass.
Patty, thanks for coming here. Everybody check out the first season of House of the Dragon, available to stream on Max, which is available right here on Roku. Season 2 of the show, currently in production. Great to have you here, sir.
Thanks for having me.
You got
it's been
it.
Great.
Same here. Come back anytime. Patty Considine here on The Rich Eisen Show.
For decades, Rolling Stone has set the bar for entertainment publications. Today, Rolling Stone Music Now takes over in podcast form. Songwriter and producer Jamie Hartman reacts to the Ed Sheeran verdict.
You need to create something new, and of course you're going to use traditional paths to get there. Are you going to sue the Rolling Stones for making a samba out of Sympathy for the Devil? Are you going to sue Elvis Presley for writing Bossa Nova? It's like saying you're not allowed to use a pencil to create a piece of art.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
We're back here on the Rich Eisen Show in the studio. That was fun with Patty Considine. Oh, yeah. I love the Bourne movies. They never get old. Brian Cox.
Yeah. Brian Cox, you forget that he's in it.
Mm-hmm. Logan, way before he was Logan Roy.
Way before.
Truly.
Treadstone.
They were all great. All of them.
Yeah.
When was the last time you saw the first Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise?
The first one?
Yes.
Not that long ago, probably a few months.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I saw it just a few months ago,
too.
It's
so great. It's great. It's still so awesome.
I'm thinking
awesome.
Of showing it to the kids, actually.
You know, it's not that bad.
It's confusing, though.
It's a little confusing because there's the knock list and the fake knock list and then the backstabbing.
Right.
And
the drop is the first one, right?
Yeah, yes. That's the first one.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's...
With the heat sensor and his
sweat dripping.
Yeah,
right.
And sweat. Yep.
The French
you
guy.
Know, and the noise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slips.
Oh my gosh. I remember when that first came out, it was like, it was an eye opener. But Matt Damon is as in the Bourne movies.
The first Jason Bourne movie is just.
But the other ones are just as good.
Yep.
Right?
There was the one where they tried to make Renner Bourne, and then that didn't work. And then they brought Matt Damon back for the fourth one.
I'm talking about Damon.
Yeah.
The Damon ones. Jeremy Renner's great in his own right in everything that he does.
It just didn't work as that.
Well, I mean, it's Matt Damon.
Right. I mean, now Renner got into the Mission Impossible lane. So
well, like, Renner also got into the Marvel Universe
Marvel
lane, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It worked out for Renner.
Big. He's in the 49er lane, too. Do you see any time, every now and then, Renner will retweet or like one of our 49er videos? Like every other nutty person in 49er Nation?
I'm glad that Renner's still with us, man, after what
I know, exactly right. Exactly right. All right, we're back here on the Rich Eisen Show on the Roku channel. Back here on the Rich Eisen Show radio network with our Roku channel stream sitting at the Rich Eisen Show desk furnished by Grainger with supplies and solutions for every industry. Grainger is the right product for you. Call clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Nish in New York, you're here on the Rich Eisen Show. How you doing, Nish?
Hey, Rich, how you guys doing today?
How are you? What's going on?
Great. So I've got one, what's least likely to TJ and Brockman. And then, Rich, I've got a Michigan Jets dilemma question for you.
Okay, run through it.
But just wanted to start off by saying, you know, you guys kind of are who I spend my afternoons with every single day. And so,
great.
You know,
thanks, brother.
love what you guys do and appreciate you having me on.
Appreciate you being on.
Thanks, man.
So as a big Jets fan, what's least likely? TJ or Brockman showing up to work the day after Aaron does his thing and beats the Cowboys and Patriots, respectively?
Okay. Or?
Well, who's least likely to show up to work?
Oh, who's least? They'll both show up to work. First of all, they're professionals. Secondly, they have no shame. So what's your other question?
Yeah, I showed up after game 7.
Because if we lose, there was a reason. It was on the refs
understood.
Or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, so,
exactly.
Yeah.
Mac Jones got hurt.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah, got that. So the second question is, loved your interview with Reggie yesterday, Rich, and as a big Yankee fan, love how you bought some Stewisms in there, and as a Carolina guy, one of the most, I think, memorable and awesome experiences of my life was seeing Stuart Scott host Late Night with Roy back in 2010. And my sister went to Michigan, and I promised her that I would take her to the big game after Thanksgiving in Ann Arbor this year.
Okay.
But then the NFL decides to put the first ever Black Friday game on that Friday at the Meadowlands. And I guess question two is, what game should I go to?
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing. Nish, there are direct flights from New York, New Jersey to Detroit. So there's no excuse. Go to both. Go to both.
I mean.
Go to both. You go to, if you're living in New York, you're calling from New York, you live in New York, kickoff 3:30 right there on Black Friday. Let's see if there's is there a 10 o'clock flight out of Newark to Detroit? Chris, you want to try and check it out for him? Do you need us to be a travel agent for you?
Travel?
6 a.m. flight, 7 a.m. flight next day. Get some rest. You know, get some rest. Don't party too hard after the Jets win on that Black Friday against the Dolphins. Wake up next day. Go to both. Done. End of story.
Well,
and you're welcome.
Are you going to be there?
No. Thank you for the call, though, Nish.
Well, I do, Rich, I do have a bone to pick with you.
Oh, my gosh.
I DM'd you on New Year's Eve in Scottsdale and never got a response back when I took my sister out to the we don't have to talk about the outcome of the game, but...
No, I'm sorry, Nish. I didn't, you know, thanks for the call, pal. Appreciate it. Be well. I didn't check my DMs.
Lots of nonstop flights.
There you go.
JetBlue, United, Delta. United, yeah, come on. You have to go through
Chicago. Newark, focus.
Newark to Detroit.
Gotta focus. Let's go. By the way, I thought Nish in New York, there, but way back in the day, there was a bouncer, a guy who worked the door named Nish in New York, a couple of establishments. I thought that was him.
Was that during your, boring. Hey, it's Stu and the white guy.
That's
days.
It. Yeah. Those were the days.
Yeah.
Nish in New York.
Speaking of the days, 20th anniversary today.
I saw that. Congrats, congratulations.
Rich. 20. Susie and I, 20 years ago tonight.
How about
married,
that?
Yes. Oof. Married in New York City 20 years ago. And we are...
what are you doing tonight?
What are we doing tonight? Getting ready for a vacation. Getting ready. Got three kids. I think one of them's got another party. I mean, these end of the year parties.
Oh, gosh.
Dude. But anyway, love you, Suze. Put out an Instagram post today that speaks from my heart, as well as here on the show.
There you go.
I know. What are you getting me?
What am I getting you?
Yeah.
For what?
Us.
Who?
20 years.
Who?
We live. By the way, the 20 years are in Los Angeles, California. Do you understand what this means?
I don't.
20 years in Los Angeles, California.
That's like 80 years.
Yeah. It's like dog years. Yeah.
You know? It's like dog years.
Yeah.
What are you getting me?
What do you mean getting you? What are we getting you?
What are you getting me?
What do you mean?
My 14th LA anniversary is coming up.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Yeah, you in Los Angeles still together after all these years.
It's the same.
Mm-hmm. All those little cities you gave birth to that you're still, you know.
Exactly.
That sucked the life out of you.
I'm confused. Mm-hmm. What is 20? What is the gift?
20's got it. It's got to be... 25 silver.
The gift is
got to be something.
Hopefully it's a wood anniversary.
Fine china or porcelain.
There you go.
Oh, very good. Put that in our new home.
There you go.
Very good. Lots going on in my world. I'm a 53-year-old man.
Your old home that looks a little different.
Very good.
Oh, like in LA, your home got a facelift.
Ah.
Where you're all we try to be.
Your home got some nip and tuck.
That's very good. Very good. Lots of questions for you to ask Susie when she's in this chair next time for our 20 years ago tonight. The Central Park Boathouse.
The party was
Dan Patrick up behind the Dan Patrick up behind the bar while we were taking photographs with the family members.
Most famous person at your wedding was?
Ooh, yeah.
Like Irvin?
Yeah, well he just went to the reception, not the party.
Okay.
So
he was a last minute invite, right?
Was from Susie.
From Susie. Yeah.
Again. Everybody I know that's worth a damn, I met through her. Probably including you.
Definitely me.
Terry Crews coming up in hour 3. I met on my own. Dan Patrick got behind the bar while we were taking family photos. Chris Fowler said Dan thought that the drinks weren't coming fast enough.
I've partaken with Dan. He's probably a really good bartender.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dan, so if you know Dan, then he probably left early without telling anybody goodbye. That's what he does. His wife Sue was there.
Dan likes to drink and
they were the ESPN table, Susie Culver, Linda Cohn, Mike Tirico, Chris Fowler, Stuart Scott. Dan,
heavy hitters.
Peter Gammons.
Hey, really?
Susie knew
from Boston. Nice.
Yeah, Peter Gammons there. Huh?
Was Stevie B there at that point?
He and his lovely wife Carol were about just to have twins, so they could not travel. But Steve did birth me a new contract with NFL Network right around that time, which led to a couple of seats being empty from ESPN executives.
Oh.
Yeah.
So Brockman, myself, and TJ could have possibly come to the...
And then just to say this, put it up. Thank you, Mike Hoskins. There's Stuart Scott at my wedding 20 years ago tonight. He looks at me, and because he knew that Susie and I were just friends for a while, and I wanted to be more than that for 3 years, and he kept on pushing Susie and I together and saying to me, hang in there, and Suze, maybe you should, you know, give this guy a shot. So there he is on that photograph. You wouldn't mind putting up one more time there. He's looking at me, smiling at me, saying, you know, congratulations. And then that look is also, we did it.
Right.
That's what Siri did. We did it.
Conspiracy theories. Paranormal. UFOs.
Science teacher Andrew Greenwood stated that a child ran into his classroom and was hysterically screaming and talking about the flying saucer outside.
Hundreds of children ran out of their classrooms to go outside and see this unidentified flying object that was just above the school.
Just imagine a bunch of kids running out of school. Most of them probably just ran home.
Theories of the Third Kind on YouTube or wherever you listen.